Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
And we're back. I'm joined in the studio this morning by Limerick professor Orla Muldoon, who's published a major new book on psychological trauma. And it details evidence about how traumatic experiences can, under various conditions, it can impact people's political passions and appetite for social change and bring people together and so on. Welcome, Orla Muldoon. Congratulations.
Thank you very much, Oliver.
Founding professor of psychology, we should say, in UL.
That's right.
Beautiful campus. You're, I think, the nicest one in the country.
Thank you very much.
You would say that.
I'll take that as if I own it.
So we know you do the columns in the Irish Times very often, and you're not afraid to have a go.
And in fact, haven't done them in a good while because
you were busy
spending
doing this.
Time. Writing the book took me a little while.
And so you're doing papers, and they're the serious papers that maybe academics only read, and the rest of us kind of struggle with them and so on. Mm. So what inspired you to write this book?
Well, you've put your finger on it there, for sure. You can write an awful lot as an academic and nobody ever reads anything except maybe four people that you forced, students.
Well, they could be very important people though at the same time. It's not nobody reads them.
Nobody reads them, but some are widely read, but it is other academics.
Yeah.
So I guess I wrote the book for a couple of reasons. It was an itch that was there and it needed
very
to be
good.
Scratched.
Yeah.
And I had promised myself I would do it. Frustration listening to people on the radio. I listen to a lot of radio. Never you, Oliver.
Delighted to hear you.
You never frustrated when I would listen to you. And they would say things like, I was traumatised because I lost my childminder. And I'd find myself shouting at the radio, no, you weren't traumatised. Well, obviously, if your childminder died in your kitchen, you could be traumatised. But
the
inconvenience of your childminder, moving to another person to mind their children is not considered trauma.
Okay.
So it was partly that there was seemed to be a lot of misunderstanding out there about trauma. And I guess the last thing I would say is I'm a long time teaching undergraduate students.
Mm-hmm.
And they often find the perspective that I use difficult to understand. So I felt that things needed to be written in a different way, not in an academic way.
Now, we are devaluing the term trauma. But like in a country like ours, and we're kind of a rich Western country, obviously know our own history and so on. Is it something that, does everyone experience the stress of trauma at some point in their lives, basically?
It would be very unusual to meet someone who had a traumatic experience. Most of us have many traumatic experiences in our lives. And most of us come back from them. But yet when we think about how people talk about trauma, they mostly talk about people who do badly, about mm-hmm. people who become sick. And the focus of this book is how it is we get through. So
yes.
If most people are getting through, the focus of the research should be about, actually, this is how you get through.
Okay.
Not, this is how you get sick.
Yes, okay. So rather than saying this is trauma and so on, what can you offer us then, those of us with all the trauma?
This too will pass. I think is okay. One of the best lines that was ever given to me by my sister. And I do think that if something dreadful happens to you, it is normal to feel dreadful.
Yeah.
Do you know, if an extreme event happens in your life, if you're in a car accident where somebody is killed, or if you see something horrendous, mm-hmm. it isn't abnormal to feel terrible. And I think we need to acknowledge that and allow ourselves to feel like that.
Why do we have to point that out?
I think because mostly that if you allow yourself to be labelled into being ill because of your extreme reaction, or indeed if we label other people, if we decide that Oliver is sick because he's after,
he's after
being in that accident there, everybody starts mollycoddling Oliver instead of letting Oliver come back and Oliver find his way. And maybe Oliver drinks too much during that period.
It's because
I'm projecting here. Yeah, I mean, like when bad things happen to me, I know that I overconsume alcohol. But some that, and that would be called self-medicating. It would be kind of the line that would be used. But the reality is that that's because it was terrible. The thing that happened was terrible. But you do come back from it. And sometimes what people need is time and support and letting them do it their own way, rather than someone coming in and saying, oh God, better take Oliver out of there now because he's not fit.
I see, yeah, yes.
Because you kind of turn the person into a patient or a problem.
And we don't know when it then becomes an indefinite period of illness, for the want of a better description.
Yeah, well, it's probably more likely to become an illness when you do that. When you,
is that right?
You know, okay. When you take control away from people. So one of the things that we look at a lot is how you empower people who are actually in very disempowered, isolating positions. So a lot of trauma is about being isolated and not being able to say what happened to you. People not being willing to acknowledge what happened to you. Are people not being willing to listen to how you feel, or maybe stigmatizing you for what happened to you? Okay. Classically, in examples like rape, or maybe if somebody belonging to you went to prison. Do you know that kind of thing is very stigmatizing, and then you don't get a chance to connect with people.
You avoid the topic then, probably.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's also part of the stepping around the issue.
Okay. Yeah.
Grief, obviously, is a big one, isn't it? And we don't know what to say to people in grief.
Yeah.
Because they're probably suffering anger initially.
Grief is a big one, but that's a very good example of a trauma that many people have.
Yes.
And many people, you know, move through that. I'm not using the phrase get over, because I'm very, you know, it can still change you.
Yeah.
Do you know, so if you
lose... that's an instruction, isn't it? Get over it.
Yeah, but I mean,
it's not very helpful.
No. But I do think that you can move forward from it. But that isn't to say that you're not changed.
Okay. You change permanently?
I think many people can change permanently from big traumatic events, yeah.
And you're saying to us, that's not the end of the world. You're supposed to. Your life is different now because of the traumatic incident. Is that what
Absolutely,
you're saying?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think it can change your priorities. And maybe one of the things I do in the book is I try and use examples.
Yes.
And I use myself as the example.
You do. And you're also pointing out that that's very unusual to do in the scientific community.
Yes.
Is there somebody frowning right now? What has she done?
I would say there is probably somebody frowning, yes. So certainly in psychology, there is an obsession in psychology to be a science. And I think it's because psychology sees itself as the little sister or brother of chemistry and physics. So there is an obsession about, you know, appearing scientific.
Right. So, detached.
Detached.
Cold.
So therefore, to use yourself as the example in an academic book is like a no-no. But I suppose over the years, when I've been teaching this material to students, I've always gotten the best response when I've given them examples. And then I like to think of myself as very, very funny, at least two verys. And I get the best reaction when I give examples about my own family. But of course, you can't have a go, you know, about, you know, your kids or whatever, you know, in a book. Mm-hmm. Although I do like to mock them a lot.
Your kids?
So they're probably at this moment saying that would be trauma.
But,
I guess I use myself as the example because it's the only way ethically that you can.
Mm. But you use an excellent example because you started out by saying, look, we all get traumatized at some point. Mm. And sometimes you're thinking, oh, no, I didn't really. But lockdown was very traumatic for the collective and the individual, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And this is where your experience begins, because you had a terrible grief in the worst possible circumstances of lockdown.
Yeah, and I think I really, when I look back on that, so my father died in April 2020. Mm-hmm. And at that stage, really, we weren't organised at all. The country wasn't organised at all. And for people like me and my family and many other families at that stage, so he was in hospital, we couldn't go and see him, we couldn't get him out of the hospital. It was like, so, you know, people always said, oh, you can do it afterwards. But for some groups, you were just losing time, and that time, sure, it was a time sensitive issue. Mm-hmm. And nobody wanted to lose time with an ailing parent. Then we did manage to get him, when I say we, collectively, my younger sister really pulled it off that she got him out of the hospital and got him home, and we wanted to look after him at home. Yeah. And that was an absolute disaster because there was no supports. It was still at the point where palliative care wasn't, everybody was very nervous of being in each other's houses. We were still at the hazmat suit stage. Mm-hmm. So instead of kind of being able to look after him and kind of mind him in death, and for me, feel like I had done my duty as a daughter, we couldn't, and he had a terrible end. He had no palliative care. He was in pain. It was like really so. Obviously, the person who suffered the trauma was my father. Mm-hmm. But I guess part of the reason I use that narrative is to demonstrate that a huge amount of trauma is social. It wasn't me that had pain.
Yeah.
It was, do you know, you can be traumatized by, you know, this, you know, feeling empathy for this other person and the vicarious nature of trauma. So it is a social construct.
He suffered the pain, but you were traumatized by his pain.
Yeah, and we had no, like, lots of other things, like we couldn't have a funeral. The things that might have helped us, like the relatives all rocking up and the nostalgia and all the, you know, remembering and positive, that was all taken away.
Did he get to die at home?
He did get to die at home, but it was... wasn't good. So he got what he wanted in that he got to die at home, but he didn't get to die at home peacefully, which I think is, he hated hospital. So, I mean, I'm glad we got him home, but it wasn't a good thing. And we didn't have the support of the state or the health service. We didn't have the support of our family. Do you know, the siblings in America, the wider network, all of that was gone.
They couldn't come.
No. And it wasn't even at the point that, you know, later then people lined the streets when,
it wasn't even at that stage.
It was too early. So it was like, it was the most discombobulated, you know.
Well, no one's ever experienced, even in the worst of times.
Yeah. And I do think as Irish people, we love a funeral and it serves a function. Mm. It reminds us of the connections to the past and to all our wider network. And all of that was taken from us. And I think it made it more difficult.
So what was it like then? So the people who were here, who could go to his house, you couldn't be there when he died, for instance? Was he alone?
No, I was there and my sister was there.
Okay.
Yeah, but my mother had died maybe 9 months previously.
The
palliative care system was just unbelievable.
Right.
Do you know, we had people in and out. It was, you know, the palliative care nurses explaining things. We had all sorts of services and, you know, these pumps and every, you know, like it was just chalk and cheese.
Right.
So to me, and of course we had this funeral where all of these people arrived who said, oh, I haven't seen you since you were in nappies. And, you know, and reminded us of our mother when she was young and what, you know,
all the things that you need.
And
that this was the opposite.
This was the complete opposite. And I still feel like we didn't, that we didn't give him a good send off, I suppose, is probably, do you know, that we. Yeah.
And he knew it too.
Yeah. And it leaves you feeling a little bit bereft. Beyond the usual. Mm. Do you know, obviously I miss my mother, but I really feel like I let my father down.
Oh God. But there was nothing you could do. I mean, it was a worldwide pandemic. It was fear, panic across the whole world.
Yeah, and I think if it had even been a little bit later, but I'm sure there are many people out there listening to this who feel like they lost time with the loved one during the pandemic. And there was a lot of talk at the time about how we would, do you know, when it was over. But some of us never got that. I never will get that time back. Never will get to fix that. And that is really the social nature of trauma. Do you know that? And that's really what the book is about.
It's 4 years later and that trauma is still with you.
Yeah, and I don't think I'll ever really look back and say, I'm happy with how that went.
No, you couldn't.
Yeah.
There's anger in there as well. So are these all effects?
Well, yes. And I would say that some of us maybe have difficulty articulating our anger. I like to channel it. But I think anger is a functional emotion. And the psychologists will tell you that anger can be the thing that precipitates political action.
Okay.
So I would say, now at the time I did work to kind of try and get the voices of what I would say were not the sort of middle class, middle income males that were running the show. I did try and counter that. I think I've probably become more difficult on that now, because I think that there are very many ways in which far too much in Ireland, in Europe, in the world, is governed by what suits middle class, middle income, urban dwellers who are disproportionately male. And I think that we forget that there are loads and loads of people out there that that system isn't working for.
The people with power. And they're detached from
and
the people who suffer as a result of
they're making
bad
rules, you know, that they're making rules that they think suit the masses, but they're forgetting that actually there's a whole swathe of people that their priority is caring for others, not whether or not the economy is good.
Yeah, growth at any cost. What do we do then? Because you talk about before we ask people to fix themselves, we need to make sure that it isn't their world that is broken. You mean exactly what you're talking about there, the world around them isn't broken.
Yeah.
So can you be fixed from trauma if the world is the problem?
Yeah. Now, there's this million-dollar question. I think it's very hard to ask people to fix themselves. So if they have to go back into a situation. So one of the things, so say for an instance, if somebody who's been sex trafficked and you say, this person has been repeatedly raped, and you want to, you know, you want them to recover. Now, the likelihood of them having recovery if they have to go back into the situation where they're going to be sexually abused again, or indeed if we take situations of political violence, where there's ongoing political violence, you cannot expect people to have no distress over the experience of war or gender-based violence if they're going back into a situation where they're going to be exposed to that again.
Where the issue continues on.
Yeah, I mean, that's just silly.
And the trauma becomes very secondary, doesn't it? In the war zones we know at the moment, for instance, if it's still going on, you know, no one's even thinking about the trauma they're suffering. They're trying to get them to safety, or, you know, they're being fixed up in hospital or whatever.
Okay, I'm going to disagree with you there
and
say that sometimes what people do is think a little bit too much about the trauma. So I think we have had instances in Palestine and Gaza recently where people are talking a lot about the trauma of the children. Well, there's a very good way to stop children in Gaza being traumatised, and that would be to stop the war. But sometimes what people are doing when they're focusing on the trauma that people have is they're not focusing on the need to stop and prevent the situation. So you still feel as if you're doing something, because you say, no, we must help these women and children. And we always say the passive victims, we always say the women and children, like we're going to ignore the men with the trauma. So do you know, And that focus on helping people with trauma can actually take your eye off the main ball, which is actually we need to stop what's happening.
Fixing the world there is an easier, as it is in Ukraine.
You see the same when you think about gender-based violence. You often see people talking about, we really need to figure out a way of stopping domestic violence or stopping sexual assault. You know, we need, but actually, they might think about that, but they're often more focused on the support of women who have experienced it. But actually, could we just stop it? Could we focus on who is doing the violence and get them to stop?
Talk about the how gender is related to the different types of traumatic events for men and women.
So when you look at huge, big academic studies, you find that there are kind of five main types of trauma. Two of them are related to war and violence, disproportionately men. In that, feeling the brunt of that in terms of their psychological trauma or their traumatic experience. And then two are related to gender-based violence, domestic violence being one and sexual assault being the other, disproportionately women. So the nature of the traumatic experience that men and women have are quite different. So even in Ireland, you find that the very high levels of street violence, mostly men, very high levels of sexual assault, mostly women. So the kinds of trauma faced by men and women tend to be quite different.
So the random acts of violence on the streets, it's men attacking men, mostly. Whereas women, when they're the victims of violence, it tends to be someone they know.
I'm going to have to do it again. we can't. The phrase random acts of violence is something that I spend a long time saying.
They're fighting
not,
against.
Yeah, I'm fighting against you. They're not,
it's not random.
They're very patterned.
Yeah.
So young men are likely to be the people who get a kick in the head, and young women are likely to be the people who are raped and sexually assaulted. So actually,
and in domestic situations,
oldies like us are relatively safe. It's so those things tend to be problems of the young that are gendered. In domestic violence situations, it's disproportionately women who are affected and children. And I think sometimes children are forgotten in the domestic violence situation. But actually, in places like Canada, domestic violence is considered child abuse. Once it's in the home at all, it's considered child abuse.
And treated as such. Mm. The Me Too movement was very important globally for calling out the gender-based violence you're talking about. And this is where we get to the crux of the social change, when people realise it's not just them, that they're not alone suffering the trauma. They talk to each other, and then you have movement for political change.
Yes. So some of the work we have done shows that how women who have experienced gender-based violence, rape, sexual assault, how it can actually increase a collective consciousness. So I think it's fair to say that people aren't quick to say that they've been sexually assaulted. Sometimes they don't think it's worthy of comment, or sometimes they're embarrassed or shamed or think that it's their own fault. So that shuts them down in terms of talking. I think what Me Too did was allowed people to say, and that then increases collective consciousness. So some of the data we have shows that women can become activated, so they can start seeing themselves as activists, or maybe as feminists, but activist is more likely to be the identity. And that sort of sense of themselves, collective self, as being part of something bigger than themselves, allows them to affect political action.
Does it help them deal with the trauma?
Yes.
Because now, they're in a new group.
Yes, they're in a new group and they get this sense of purpose.
Yes.
Now, that isn't to say that you know, they're not still upset that this thing, or that they're glad this thing happened
to them. I'm thinking of the Stardust victims, survivors, relatives who spent 40 years campaigning and probably only know each other because of that evening. A lot of them now obviously came from a particular area. But you can think of lots of causes, can't you? The postmasters in the UK who came together and affected change, although it took a long time as well.
Yeah. And I think that I listened a lot to the Stardust interviews and the families, and they definitely drew strength from each other. There is no question about it. But it also was very interesting that they were a very low income, low power group. And that's typical of people who have trouble getting political change, that they're coming from a sort of a low level of power. But I do think they would have drawn strength from each other. I'm not sure that they would ever say they were glad this had happened, but they have, I think many of us would say that they have demonstrated an incredible amount of tenacity. And I mean, it's just incredible that they lasted as long as they did to get the result that they did.
Do we have some kind of power in our ancestral brains? Because obviously we've been on this planet for a long time, and trauma was every day for, you know, once upon a time. For the hunter-gatherer human, they used to kill the weak one, whether they were old or young, sick, because the tribe had to move on and that was like keeping the collective. So how did they just deal with it better than we do now today? Were they tougher?
And were they tougher? Maybe. I think one of the narratives that's abroad at the moment is that we have a snowflake generation arriving, you know, who are really bad at managing, you know, any little thing at all, and they're off. I would say that context is really important. So the environment is really important to how people manage stress. And our snowflake generation are a generation living in a very much more unequal world than me as a child of the 80s.
Now, snowflake is a derivative term, obviously. It's a pejorative term.
It is.
It's meant to do down anyone whoever's calling someone a snowflake. They're being accused of being traumatized for something very
minor.
Something very minor.
Yeah, you're traumatized because you couldn't get avocado toast, I think, would be the typical kind of nasty narrative. Mm. But that generation are a generation who are finding it very hard to secure housing, permanent employment, all of the things that children of the 80s took for granted, and many of us got permanent and pensionable jobs and mortgages. So it is more difficult to cope with events if you don't have a secure base.
I see what you mean, yes.
Okay. So I think that's some of the change across time is to do with that. But I mean, in terms of relative to hunter or gatherers, there is evidence that we are actually built to deal with stress. Now, not stress all the time, but I think I would bring it back to the idea that most of us, 90% of us, are resilient to psychological trauma. That doesn't mean that doesn't mean that we're happy about things that happen to us, you know.
But we can deal with it. Is it healthy to expose, I don't know how to put it, like some kind of level of psychological trauma to kids at a young age to kind of prepare them for tough things in later life? For example, you know, describing a relative has died, maybe the circumstances or illness or something that's going on in the world, like war. Is there a healthy level that you can expose children to psychological trauma, which will tool them up for later in life when something happens?
Okay, so I would say that there's a difference between exposing them to psychological trauma and them encountering normal everyday stress. Of course, children should be taught how to live with the ups and downs of life. That's what's coming. So they have to learn, you know, how to win, how to lose, how to succeed, how to fail. That's very different to psychological trauma, or what's sometimes now called adverse childhood experiences, like hitting them, abusing them, locking them under the stairs. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a very different thing.
I sort of mean, you know, like your grandparent has died, they're not coming back, you're not going to see them again.
No, I think that would be better. You'd be better telling them that.
It's better telling them that, but you wouldn't call that a traumatic. It could be traumatic though, couldn't it?
It could, of course, be traumatic, yeah.
But it's healthy.
Yes, and in fact, we've done work with families where the dad has gone to prison. And one of the things that's really strange about this group is that sometimes the mammies don't tell the children that the daddy is in prison. And to a child, when we speak to them, and you know, even if the parent's there, they somehow communicate to us that they know fine rightly where the father is.
Okay, right. They're not traumatised by either.
Well, they are
traumatised maybe by the lie, are they? They're
very traumatised, and they're complicit in pretending that this isn't true. So children often know,
or
they
know
that there isn't something, that there's something dishonest happening. And they participate in that dishonesty. And that's very stressful because they want to be able to talk openly, the same as you and I.
There are lots of messages coming in. I want to come to those. We're going to take a quick break, though, before we do. Stay with us, Orla Muldoon. We'll be back in a second. Professor Orla Muldoon is here. Lots of messages on psychological trauma. This person says, the last year of my life has been the most traumatic. My best friend died. I had to get sudden life-saving surgery. Upon waking, the first message I received was from my fiancé who dumped me after 8 years. How do you stop losing hope? My dad got a heart attack. Dog got killed before my eyes. I'm honestly losing hope, says Si. How do you stop losing hope? If we can do it in a minute, Orla. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so losing hope I know about, and I lost a friend to suicide many years ago, and I suppose I'll give you the advice that I found eventually, which is look to even one or two people who make you feel like that good friend made you feel, and hang on to them. And maybe just even one thing a day, just do one thing a day. Be very easy on yourself, go easy on yourself.
It's hang okay on to feel miserable.
Yeah, hang on to one person and do one thing a day.
We want to say to everyone who sent us loads of messages as well, rt.ie/helplines has lots of support lines, and people non-judgmentally will listen to you. To the people who as well who are talking about people traumatised, they'd no rituals, lost loved ones during the lockdown, nobody wants to talk about them. You totally agree with that we need to examine that, don't we? There are a lot of answers in this book. It's The Social Psychology of Trauma by Orla Muldoon, Cambridge University Press are the publishers, and this is free. You can actually get this for free as well on cambridge.org/core. Isn't that correct?
Yes.
The whole book is there.
Yeah, so the whole
everyone.
Book is available on PDF on the Cambridge website.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for coming into us. And I hope people get a little bit of relief or a bit of hope there.
0818 715 925. Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.